Okay. In fact, a word of explanation first. I might have a stutter, as in fact you can hear. So I pre-record all of my poems kind of onto a disc for each reading, and kind of each one is entirely unique, and it's thrown away afterwards. So you get a specific reading, as it were. So this first one is called The Gorgon's Palace, and it's from my first collection, and I hope it's going to work. Otherwise, it's not. Right, let's see what happens. Okay.
The Gorgon's Palace. There is a dark place in my eye, like a thread or limb of mind, that wavers when I turn to see, though a mirror shows there's nothing there. I looked upon a bowl of flowers with my eye towards its heart, and saw the blossoms fold in two and vanish in a stick of light, as if a hinge had folded shut. Then it all flowed back again. The bowl of flowers was on the shelf. But after that I found the scent of every living thing had changed. I went into a market square, a festive day of wind-borne kites, and gazed upon the busy stalls, and watched the people fall to dust, till just the field of flowers remained. But one pale woman still stood there, so lovely as to stop my breath, for all her hair was full of smiles, her glance as long as winter night. I stood among those deep-hued flowers, in the silence of the sun, all wrapped about with winking hair, with kisses twitching through my limbs, so stunned I couldn't move at all. Then the marketplace came back, and people laughed and toiled once more. And now the world around me turns, while a gorgon preens beneath my skin.
Okay, I live on in the north side of Dublin, close to the Botanic Gardens, and I often wander around there and write. And this is one which I wrote in there. So,
lay my corpse. Lay my corpse, lax and lilied, beneath a willow, so its roots can lap and suck at me, and draw me up its stem like spring, pouring green onto the cooling brilliance of the grass. Or fix that I be fed to swans, or maybe geese, and flying far from winter's deathy chill, upon the gusting muscles of the air, alight at last in deepest Africa, the strange familiar origin of things, where bright among the pawpaws, figs, and lemons, wings are neither grey nor white, but many-coloured, like the child of rain and sunlight, and where the conversations of the laughing dead sway like all the weeping willows of the world.
In the second collection, which has just been published, I've written, I suppose, about 20% of the poems are reimaginings of the Christ story in one way or the other, and some of them are very, you know, off-center, and some are respectful and some perhaps aren't. But this is my take on the ascension, and it's called The Body.
The Body. He was not raised bodily to heaven, as they said. Though when the God was torn out of the man, he was without weight, and drifted like thistle down upon the breeze. The children, shouting with delight, ran after him to see he was not harmed, and caught him as he passed across the vineyards, and brought him home tied to a string. As he bobbed about above our heads, and his empty eyes gazed up towards the blue, the summer breeze twittered through his wounds, so that they spoke with the tongues of birds. At once from the branches birds began to sing, as if to the going down of the sun, and even husks and stones and other mouthless things seemed somehow to be singing too. That stormy night he slipped away, the string was hanging limp when morning came. But we dreamed he was lifted by the winds to sail forever high above the world, close to the stars, cleansed by gentle rains, too holy for the earth, too gross for heaven, his whistling still ignored by the chilly dark, though carried far on late migrating wings.
The next kind of, in fact, the next one is actually rather hard to talk about. It's but I think I'm just going to okay. It's called the Bad Back.
The Bad Back. There was a bad back that circled round, doing people grievous harm, that hid itself behind us all, and no one knew which back it was, though some thought there was more than one. Wild rumours were flying about that it was a devil's back, a lost soul, or even Christ in vengeance for what was done behind his back. And all of these the kind of being we've been told is always close, yet out of sight. And something had been seen moving through the woods, lighting its way with a moon tied with string behind the face of floating hair. The days are already short behind my house, where the shadows fall and the trees stoop, where the backs of things stay unrevealed, a hidden world forever closed. Could my own back turn bad, do things like that? I was tending the dying geraniums one Thursday in that dreary patch behind the house. Something had been touching them, or had they always smelled so odd? But then I tried to go in for tea and found the house locked from within. I ran off panicked through the woods, but heard something at my back, caught a glimpse of moon glow quickly gone, then felt it underneath my clothes, wriggling up against me, and I heard it coo. At my friend's house I tore off my shirt and used some mirrors to check it out. He laughed. Of course you'd know your own back. Then, did you just say something?
In the first collection, I wrote quite a few about set in the medieval times and the Knights of the Round Table era. And this is one that's called The Treasure, and it deals with some of the very unique things that were supposedly left over after the creation. One-offs which weren't sort of spiritual or material, kind of completely or angelic, and that couldn't actually have a label properly applied to them because They weren't, you know, kind of, in fact, there were no criteria to kind of express kind of actually what to compare with what they were. So this is about one of those, basically, and it's called The Treasure.
The Treasure. We carried the treasure on our shoulders as we walked across the sea, and others who were in a state of grace processed along the saint's wide shirt sleeves, stepping from the cuffs at the same time as he set foot on the other shore. Behind us, the brutal and the avaricious struggled to find passage in boats and ships, but were held in port by sudden storms. We put the treasure in its sanctuary, then went our way. But a certain knight returned to the place, and ignoring the cry of warning from a burning cloud, went in, and was struck blind and was paralyzed, a small loss, he felt, compared to having glimpsed the treasure in its open joy unveiled. Only his tongue was unaffected, and in a chapel specially built nearby, he praised God ceaselessly for 2 centuries, while he lay upon a bier before the host.
The next poem is sort of a political poem. It's really about any outsiders, how society will squash an outsider flat for the sake of expediency, and it's called Giuseppe, and it's set in a Second World War. So let's have a look.
Giuseppe. My uncle Giuseppe told me that in Sicily, in World War II, in the courtyard behind the aquarium where the bougainvillea grows so well, the only captive mermaid in the world was butchered on the dry and dusty ground by a doctor, a fishmonger, and certain others. She, it, had never learned to speak because she was simple, or so they'd said, but the priest who held one of her hands while her throat was cut said she was only a fish, and fish can't speak. But she screamed like a woman in terrible fear. And when they took a ripe golden roe from her side, the doctor said this was proof she was just a fish, and anyway an egg is not a child, but refused when some was offered to him. Then they put her head and her hands in a box for burial, and someone tried to take her wedding ring, but the others stopped him, and the ring stayed put. The rest they cooked and fed to the troops. They said a large fish had been found on the beach. Starvation forgives men many things, my uncle, the aquarium keeper, said, but couldn't look me in the eye, for which I thank God.
The next poem is called in fact, An Old Woman Weeds a Grave, and the only thing I think that I have to say about it is that there is the word something kind of in the poem once, and it's spelt with a capital S, so, something with a capital S. So here we go.
An old woman weeds a grave. An old woman weeds a grave beneath a hush of ancient trees, her brown hands so gentle with this soil. And she thinks of all the love that's flown, those proud dandelions of the sun, turn to stooping worlds of grey, then blown to ghosts upon the wind, so love anew might grow again, though far away, and not for her. And in her heart she cries for love, and something hears, then someone comes. He strides the graves on tall green stilts, his hair a swirl of shining gold, and lifts her in his furry arms up the stairs of a graveyard house. And he sings his song in a voice like cream as he climbs on past the roofs and hills, heedless of the winds that roar, that sway the stairs beyond the stars. Then he comes at last to a firelit room and howls with love and slams the door.
The next poem is about, much as isolated and kind of everybody, people who live mainly in their imagination because of isolation. And this is sort of an imaginary blind person, really. This is about a kind of a fictional sort of blindness, I guess. It's called a piano tuner.
The piano tuner. Echoes, song, and smoking wax make up the church entire as he gives himself to silent hands that take him, trusting to the bread and wine. He turns over in his bed, intrigued at how his dying mind in its own way gives him what his spirit needs. He has a songbird in a cage, blinded to improve her song, who, like the soul imprisoned in his skin, made herself forget the skies and the flowered forests of her home, though underneath the sweetness of her song, he hears her pine for some long-lost love. He likes to try to guess the world of sight, the soil opening wide its many mouths to receive the swaddled dead, or the way the wings of his guardian angel surely fill this room as she sits beside his bed, watching him with eyes of stars. In the end, no angel came for him, but a fawn gripped him like a lover, and drew him out as joy leaping, self-forgotten through fields that blazed like windows in the church of summer, till he whirled to one who cried his name and flew like a bird through his heart of flowers.
The next one is another poem about Christ, and it's kind of also about the idea of, you know, the omens and other books. Thank you, James. You found the pub right.
But wrong night.
I see, all right. Okay, so it's called The Carpenter's House.
The Carpenter's House. I have dreamed these recent weeks of Rostwich, where my white-haired uncle lived. The yellow house of light-encrusted stone, the ancient gardens scaled with dappled gold, the jumbled hills that ache with green. There he shaped an image of Christ crucified from a fragile piece of the one true cross that was brought to him from the Holy Land. He painted it with tints he ground himself and set it on the wall above his lathe, a thought piece for an atheist carpenter. We took it back to our house when he died and kept it on the mantelpiece for luck. Then one spring cleaning, when it fell and broke, we found there was a seed inside its head, which I planted in a sunny flower pot, and now a skinny sapling is budding there. But I dream that in my uncle's house there's a hidden room where no one's ever been, where a giant mirror hangs upon a wall in a frame of wrinkled wood that sprouts with leaves and does not reflect anything at all. And the jumbled hills cry out with green, the ancient garden seethes with golden light. The house squats like a lump of mouldy cheese, displeased that all its rooms are bare and dark, till there's the whisper of a gently opening door, and Christ walks down the stairs with wooden feet.
Right, so let's see, two more poems. The next one is about one of my grandfathers. I have all sorts of uncles and aunts and about seven grandfathers and whatever in my poems, so I tend to put, in fact I like them. This one has bouillabaisse in it, which is a kind of fish stew, I'm sure most of you know that anyway. And the grandfather speaks in this, and in fact I have him as a kind of whispery voice, and I'm not sure whether it kind of actually comes over all right. This is the first time I've ever recorded this poem, so if you be interested to hear your opinions afterwards or whether you think that works or not. So it's called actually Opening the Door. Now this is slightly more complex.
The body.
Nope.
It was not raised bodily.
Try again.
The Gorgon's Palace.
Nope. Oops.
There is a dark jet.
Sorry. There are different. Oh, I see it. Yeah. Okay. I think. No.
Opening the door.
Yeah, that's it.
My grandfather had a special whistle for calling seabirds down to eat the waste, and a squat Sardinian garlic press of a type I've never seen again. I used to watch him working in the kitchen while gulls like shrieking flaps of cloth fought over fish guts in the cobbled yard. He'd conjure dark tureens of bouillabaisse that would taste of all the stories of the sea. We'd sup it up with hunks of fragrant bread my cousins baked, and loquacious young wines, fresh as any wind that filled a sail. Then one day he crushed a rope of garlic into a seething pan of sodden gulls he'd whistled down and hooked with rod and line, baited with the fish he should have stewed. A child was put to watch him after that, but within a year we'd burned his bones and strewn the ash from his door to the road, walking backwards in the respectful way. Now if I'm by the sea and smell hot garlic singing through some open window while gulls wheedle and hector in a burly mob, his ghost comes striding tough as any man, and we lean and talk of how when I was young he gave me so much homemade mushroom beer I turned to screams and bit my leaping limbs, my flawless terror naked as the sun. A seagull calls a worm by dancing on the grass in imitation of the rain. It was time to tear your soul from down below. How else can beauty learn to cast its shadows? But the cooking is done. The garlic's gone. The gulls just stand and stare. They make no sound. And grandfather tumbles back along the shore. The world the dead come from seems not quite sane. Painful memories are the flesh they wear. Fear brings them close, their closeness brings more fear. Yet love bids me listen trembling at each door for someone whistling for me in the rain.
And the last poem is actually about a dream inside a dream inside a dream. You know, they They sit inside each other, a bit like Russian dolls. Some of you may have seen Christopher Nolan's recent film, kind of Inception, which tries to play with the same idea, I think. It's an interesting film, I reckon. So I guess I'll try to get this one. This is the hardest one to get. So it's got all sorts of weird. Well done.
Room of Red. I went to bed with a wandering girl. Her dark hair shone with glints of moon, and we played at love in my room of red till midnight rang and the stars came down. When we went to sleep, I gladly dreamed that we played at love in a room of green. But in that dream I fell asleep and dreamt we lay in a room of black. Then the black door opened and a man stood there. "It is my husband," screamed the girl, "the one I feared for 7 years. He's come to take my soul from me." We woke at once in the room of green. "My soul has gone," she cried in fear. Then the green door opened and a man came in. "It is my husband," shrieked the girl, "the one I fled these 7 years. He's come to take my love from me." And when we woke in the room of red, she trembled as she clung to me. "Oh, husband, where's my lover gone?" I looked around, no word I said, but rent her limbs with smoking hands, then closed the door on that room so red.
Thank you very much.